from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld went before the Senate Appropriations Committee and asked for another $25 billion ASAP, most of it for the fight in Iraq. Globetrotting economist Jeffrey Sachs says he has a better idea: get out of Iraq. Tonight on Point, the price of a war and a case for ending it now. We begin tonight in Iraq with news of the heavy fighting in Karbala. U.S. tanks and helicopters attacked militiamen of the Shiite firebrand Muqtada al-Sadr, partially destroying a mosque and setting seven hotels ablaze. As many as 25 insurgents were reported killed. Six U.S. soldiers were wounded. As the fighting raged, Iraqi leaders in Najaf worked to craft a solution to the confrontation between al-Sadr and the United States. Vivian Walt is Baghdad correspondent for Time magazine. I asked her to describe exactly what's going on in Najaf.
This has been a very delicate process for days on end, Tom. What's happening is that there is a growing number of Shiite leaders, both within the governing council and also some of the clerics, some of the people attached to the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who have been trying for days to resolve this. And Sadr has essentially been refusing to meet any of them. There are several sticking points to this, and this is really far from over. One of them is that the Americans insist that Sadr turn himself into the Iraqi police, who want him on a murder charge. This really is kind of tantamount to really putting yourself on death row, essentially, at this point. And Sadr might feel he might as well just fight to the bitter end rather than doing that. That is probably the major sticking point. But there's certainly a groundswell building around Kabul and Najaf to get Sadr to quit, because it's really destabilizing the entire southern region and also putting a lot of question marks on the transition to sovereignty.
Vivian, we're reading tonight that Adnan al-Zorfi, the American-appointed governor in Najaf as of just a few days ago, is suggesting that American leaders might be reconsidering their goal of killing or capturing al-Sadr.
Yes, I think that's certainly true. And I think the Americans have really given up saying that phrase, which became a bit of a kind of mantra for them, that they would capture or kill Sadr. You really haven't heard it for the last 10 days or so. And now the message is he's in the hands of the Iraqi justice system. It's almost like they are casting it in a way as them doing the bidding of the Iraqi Ministry of Justice. Of course, the situation is rather more complicated than that. But I think that they don't want to kill Sadr. It certainly would provoke enormous unrest of various kinds in the south. I think they'd like him alive and they'd like him off the streets.
So this seems to be looking for a way for everyone to sidestep this conversation, to postpone justice for Muqtada al-Sadr until an Iraqi government is in place, and for his al-Mahdi army to stand down.
Yes. I mean, this has been the real thorny point for months now, as they've negotiated the entire transition to sovereignty. The whole issue of what to do with armed militia was really a point that nobody could resolve. It's not just Sadr, of course, but the allies of Sistani have their own army as well, the Badr Brigade, which really is itself an armed force, and so do the Kurds up north. It's just that right now we've seen Sadr's militants become very, very active as we head towards sovereignty. But this is an issue that is really far from resolved.
We see that Muqtada al-Sadr had his first press conference today since his army went on the attack in April. And he cited Vietnam and said if the Vietnamese can kick out the Americans, so can we. And in what he called an open letter to the American people, he said, look at what they've done. Look at the torture they've committed against our detainees. Could anyone who came to rid us of Saddam do this?
That's an interesting point, Tom, because in the last 2 weeks since the prison abuse scandal broke, you've heard increasing references to Vietnam among Iraqis. It's really not something that you heard at all until now. Vietnam is really not in people's minds. People would more refer to the U.S. operation in Somalia, for example, much more readily than they would to Vietnam. It's become a kind of new catchphrase among a lot of the sheikhs. I was at Friday prayers last week in which this was mentioned a couple of times as well, the fact that there are echoes of Vietnam.
Meanwhile, in Karbala, tremendous fighting overnight, we understand. At a mosque there, tremendous explosions that went on for hours. American soldiers and Iraqi soldiers chasing Mahdi army members through the streets, killing almost two dozen.
Yeah, I think they said about 25 fighters. This is really growing. This week's toll among the Mahdi army, if the U.S. figures are to be believed, would be well over 100. They've killed probably about 40 within Baghdad itself in the last couple of days. There's been heavy fighting in Sadr city on the northeast edge of Baghdad for several days in a row now. So there has been this kind of low-level fighting going on. I think the problem for the Americans is that as you have more and more of these little countries pulling out, for example, Honduras dropped out of the coalition just yesterday, these were all countries that were in charge of these little towns around the south, these Shiite towns. You're having to send more and more American troops down south to shore up what's become a kind of proliferating insurgency in the south. It's not just Karbala, but it's much smaller towns like Amara. It's stirrings of things in Nasiriyah and way down south in Basra. So it appears to still have the potential to break out in places we just didn't expect it.
Finally, Vivian, give us just a sense of Baghdad. Lots of gunfire there tonight, but not from fighting.
Yes, well, Tom, about an hour ago, the city erupted in what sounded like World War II outside my window in the Palestine Hotel. There's trace of fire all over the sky, heavy machine gun fire, which went on, I would say, for at least a half an hour without halt. I don't know how many thousands of rounds of ammunition was fired. However, this time people are celebrating, probably the biggest thing they've had to celebrate in many months. The Iraqi soccer team has just made it into the Olympics. This was their final match tonight, which they played in Saudi Arabia because it's become too dangerous to play any games here in Iraq. Of course, they haven't played internationally for many years. And I happened to spend time with some of these soccer players when they were in Baghdad about 6 weeks ago. And they really were just practicing on these little dirt tracks with just nothing, absolutely no facilities whatsoever. So it's really a good night in Baghdad for a change.
We'll savor that. Vivian, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Vivian Walt is correspondent for Time magazine. She spoke with us from Baghdad. The cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan keeps going up. Today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made the case for an additional $25 billion as a down payment on what will be required heading into the year 2005. Senator Robert Byrd asked him what the money would be used for.
The funds would be spent for operational costs and force protection costs, and I do not believe at the moment that anyone anticipates that there would be additional authorities. But it would be for personnel support costs, for combat operations, supplies, force protection, transportation, those types of things.
This week, we're talking about options in Iraq. Last night, we spoke with Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down. He reminded us of what happened when the U.S. pulled out of Somalia and urged that the United States stay the course in Iraq. Tonight, we have a different perspective from the famed economist Jeffrey Sachs. When Sachs looks at the cost of this war, he sees red. Over the past year, this big thinker who fights for the world's most impoverished nations has been sharply critical of spending on the Iraq war. The Bush administration, says Sachs, obsessively sees every problem through the lens of terror and accordingly considers itself excused from the struggle against poverty, environmental degradation, and disease. The irony is that without solutions to these problems, he writes, terrorism is bound to worsen no matter how many soldiers are thrown at it. This hour, On Point, the price of a war and a case for ending it now. Is it time to cut our losses and get out of Iraq? What would be the price of a U.S. withdrawal? Is getting out a real option or unthinkable? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on issues concerning global poverty. Since the 1980s, he has advised governments on economic policy in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, Asia, and Africa. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Jeffrey Sachs.
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So everybody's wondering what the heck to do about Iraq. You're saying get out. Give us your case, Jeffrey Sachs.
Well, we talked about half a year ago in early September.
Mm-hmm.
I said this was the wrong war without hope, in fact, of success, wrong mission based on fantasies, based on false intelligence, based on a completely misconceived idea of the U.S. position in the world.
You did indeed say each of those things.
You were a little bit shocked, I remember then, saying that people on both sides of the aisle, that all parties, all leaders, were all agreed that we should stay in. Well, I'm going to come back and basically say the same thing this evening, which is that the path that we've been traveling is a predictable disaster. We can keep at it. We can keep losing soldiers. We can keep spending tens of billions of dollars. We can utterly wreck the reputation of the United States in the world. Or we can acknowledge that this was a dreadful mistake led by a group that does not understand the world and that got us into a very deep trap. It's time to get out.
And when you say get out, what exactly do you mean?
I mean scheduling within a short period of time the withdrawal of U.S. troops, handing it over to the United Nations. I would also offer some cash to try to fulfill a mission, but this is not a mission that the United States can accomplish. We are radioactive there.
When do you imagine, in your scenario, the last U.S. troops would shove off from Iraq's shores?
Well, I would hope within 6 months. I'm not a logistics planner for the military. We'd have to withdraw safely, but end of mission.
End of mission within 6 months. That's the Jeffrey Sachs prescription here. You know that as we sit here tonight, there are still many, and still on both sides of the aisle, including the Democratic presidential leading contender, John Kerry, who are saying we have to take care of this mess in Iraq. We cannot leave behind chaos and disarray and a breeding ground for terrorism. It simply is unthinkable.
That's what we discussed 7 months ago, and I said those are all noble ideas and good thoughts, and I subscribe to all of them, except that we cannot accomplish that aim. And I predicted when we talked that things would continue to get worse. That was at a time when everyone said, just wait, things will get better. Things will not get better because we cannot accomplish that goal. Maybe some others can, but we are radioactive, as I said, in the region to have invaded the country and to have occupied the country in the middle of the most unstable part of the world with all the baggage and all of the history of that region was a predictable disaster.
And if the United States should leave, if the president should have an overnight conversion and wake up and say, by gosh, Professor Sachs is right, where do you get the confidence that there won't be a sump of chaos, civil war, anarchy, in the middle of the Middle East, right on top of the biggest oil fields in the world?
First of all, he's not going to have a conversion. He is either going to win or lose at the polls. He's not going to have a conversion because he has seen something that isn't based on evidence but is based on his faith or whatever else gives him this vision. But
we grant that, but simply to test your thesis, if we really did it, what's to keep chaos from rolling in here?
We're in the middle of chaos. What I'm saying is that we cannot accomplish the goals because our troops on the ground cannot make peace. By the way, it's the same with Israel in the West Bank to enter a neighboring territory. Military force cannot suppress this kind of rebellion without mass murder and destruction, without mass abuse of rights, and therefore without an increasing spiral of political instability.
Jeffrey Sachs, there's a lot more we want to put to you here. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with economist Jeffrey Sachs about the price of a war and his argument for ending it now. You can join the conversation. Is it, could it be, time to cut our losses and get out of Iraq? What would be the price of a U.S. withdrawal? Would it be a steeper price than staying or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the price of a war and an argument for ending it now. My guest is Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, cited on nearly every list, nearly every year, as one of the world's most influential people, a globe-trotting economist who's advised countries right across the planet. He is now advising Washington to get out of Iraq and get out quick, within 6 months, he says. So here's the question. Who is keeping it real here, George Bush or Jeffrey Sachs? Is getting out a real option, or is it unthinkable while Iraq is still in disarray? And would a U.S. withdrawal mean chaos in Iraq? Does staying mean chaos? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeffrey Sachs, if this is such a great idea, why don't we see more American officials in power in the government suggesting it?
I think everybody is afraid to suggest it, just as they were afraid to suggest getting out of Vietnam. And that war dragged on without relief, with more than 50,000 U.S. Young men killed, while we finally got up the gumption to be defeated properly, if you want to put it that way. The fact of the matter is we have a system where nobody wants to be the one associated with defeat, so we will be in there for a long time, most likely, suffering one disaster after another. But that doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it the true and appropriate course of action. We entered on false premises with completely false ideas about what awaits us, with no understanding whatsoever for the region. Clearly, with an inability to play a responsible role, with no legitimacy whatsoever, with a bleeding $5 billion a month or so for the cost of occupation, because they dribble out those costs, mm-hmm. with the neglect of virtually every other issue in this country and the world. And yes, it's not surprising to me that politicians don't want to say it, because nobody wants to be the one to say that they called for a withdrawal of Americans. It's not the American way, so-called. It just doesn't mean that staying in there is going to accomplish anything except more deaths and more disaster for American foreign policy.
There are a few voices saying this now. We've got yours tonight, and it's a big one. There's also retired Lieutenant General William Odom, who was Ronald Reagan's director of the National Security Agency, no small task, under no shrinking violet. He's saying the war does not serve U.S. interests, that it's draining the nation both materially and politically. And still, I have a sense, Jeffrey Sachs, that Americans can kind of picture the rosy scenario that we were promised, that you'd get democracy in Iraq, you'd get investment in Iraq, you'd get the oil flowing, and Iraqis would celebrate their freedom, and we'd be off to the races. It hasn't turned out that way, at least not yet. But I think a lot of people have a hard time envisioning what happens if the United States should actually go. We've been told again and again this is a recipe for civil war, for terrorism taking hold right here on top of the oil fields. Picture it for us. We get that you don't like it. We get that you don't think the U.S. can accomplish what it set out to do. But what does an Iraq with U.S. forces out at this point look like in your mind's eye?
Well, let's remember that every reason that we went in turned out to be utterly false. We're not sure whether it was just the mystical, magical thinking of this administration, besotted with an extremist ideology, or whether it was lies. But everything that was said about the role of terrorism in Iraq, about the weapons of mass destruction, turned out to be utterly false.
So are you suggesting by that we don't need to worry about chaos, civil war, al-Qaeda in Iraq, post-U.S.?
Al-Qaeda's in Iraq because we brought it in. Al-Qaeda is definitely something that the United States needs to fight. And as Mr. Clark has been making very clear, the fight against Iraq was a disaster with regard to the fight against al-Qaeda.
So we know there's been a lot of fantasy going on here. And I know that this kind of scenario planning is not necessarily what you do, but still...
I do it, and I don't fear for the scenario of getting out as much as I do for the scenario of staying in. That's the point that I'm making.
I just wish you'd get a little more concrete about that scenario of getting out and what Iraq might look like on the other side of U.S. withdrawal.
there are many possibilities because we don't have a capacity to forecast. It's possible that a country actually gets stitched together, but with the continuing violence, no doubt. It's possible that a set of fiefdoms evolves just as it has under the watch of the United States in Afghanistan, semi-independence of the Kurds, separate enclaves of the Sunnis and the Shiites. Many things are possible. I don't believe what's possible is that Iraq becomes a threat to the United States more than it is right now. It's a threat right now because it is absolutely destroying American foreign policy and bleeding us in terms of lives and in terms of financial costs. But there is no capability to launch weapons against the United States. There was a whole fantasy set up about the direct military threats from Iraq. We know this was utterly fantastic now, did not exist, certainly does not exist right now. So I don't believe that things would be riskier, and in fact, there's some chance, I wouldn't call it a good chance, but there's some chance that with the United States out, the Iraqis actually would be able to cobble together some kind of modus operandi. But right now, we did succeed in uniting most of Iraq against us, and against us in a very violent way, and against us in a predictably violent way because the dominant ideology of the region is anti-colonial. And this is what was utterly understandable beforehand, that we could not walk in or roll into the Middle East without provoking a massive explosion against us.
We're talking tonight with global economist Jeffrey Sachs. He says, get out of Iraq and get out soon. Get out essentially now. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Joe is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm an avid listener of NPR, and I think one of the reasons that I am is that I know if I listen long enough, I'll hear a voice of reason. And I think that that's come to NPR this evening in the form of Dr. Sachs. My comment is brief. I'd like to say that I'm a veteran and a patriot, an American patriot, and I'm very disturbed that we're there, and I'm one of those Americans that has not liked this war from the beginning. And I personally believe we've been led by an incompetent president who's taken some good men and women into a bad cause. And no matter how much money we throw at it and how many soldiers we send over there, it's not going to make it a good cause.
So are you on board with Jeffrey Sachs? You're saying get out?
I'm absolutely on board with Jeffrey Sachs. And I think that your question about what if we leave, the only thing that comes to my mind when I hear you saying that is...
Yeah.
Civil war isn't necessarily always a bad thing. We've gone through it ourselves, and I think the last thing that we wanted was others interfering. I think it's really an Iraqi issue if they wish to have civil war to find out where they're supposed to be. I think that's really one of their rights.
So you'd rather gamble on Iraq, even in civil war without the U.S. there, than with the odds of the U.S. bringing some kind of order without conflict.
I guess we have conflict, don't we? I think we've already demonstrated after a year of being there, and I think that Mr. Berg's death is just a symptom of something that is bad, and is probably only going to get worse. I can't imagine it getting better. And I think that sometimes, and it's difficult for America, and I don't understand why, especially for its president. It's sometimes more honorable to acknowledge that you've made a mistake than to pretend that you haven't. And I think it's time for us to stand up and say, you know, maybe we made a mistake. How can we help it now?
More likely to declare victory and go if we go at all. But, Joe, thank you very much for your call. Jeffrey Sachs, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Danielle Pletka. She's Vice President of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Good evening and welcome, Danielle Pletka.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. We're hearing an argument tonight. We're looking at options for Iraq this week, Ms. Pletka. We're hearing an argument tonight to get out of Iraq. Jeffrey Sachs saying... The country went in on bad assumptions, false pretenses. It's only getting worse. Within 6 months, the last U.S. soldier should be out of Iraq. It's time to go. What do you say?
I think that's a dreadful idea. I think even if you disagree with the premise, even if you disagree with the fact that we went in, and I think reasonable people can disagree, for the United States at this point to cut and run because we are facing some insurgency, some difficulty, and horrible terrorists is to send a signal to the world that that we are not fighting anymore. Come and get us.
So it must surely be not just avoiding the image of cutting and running. Presumably, you think that the U.S. stays, it can achieve its goals of a stable democratic Iraq. Am I right in that or not?
No, I absolutely believe that. I was a proponent of going in the first place, so I'm certainly not going to be one who argues that we should cut and run. All I'm saying is that for people who do disagree, the consequences of leaving now that we're there are so significant, would be devastating.
What do you think those consequences would be, Daniel Pletka?
First, we will send an image. We will send a signal to the world that we can be beat. It doesn't take much to send us out. After Somalia, we left. 18 soldiers died. Osama bin Laden refers to that often. After the Beirut Marine barracks bombing, 240 Marines were killed. We ran. That was what it took. Now, the death of soldiers is terrible. There are many mistakes that we're making in Iraq, and I would agree fully with anybody who said that. But the assertion that somehow this means that we should leave the mission, run away, come home, and stay behind our borders is, I think, terribly mistaken and encourages rather than discourages terrorism. As to your last question about what we should expect in Iraq,
yes.
As an outsider, one always thinks if they had done it my way, it would have worked better. And so I don't want to fall into that trap. I'm not in government, and I don't want to highly idealize. On the other hand, I think that to say that democracy, that stability are not possible in Iraq is an injustice. I think those are things worth fighting for, and I think they are eminently achievable.
Jeffrey Sachs, number one point Danielle Pletka goes to is United States credibility, if it should cut and run or pull out, as you might have it, that it would be irreparably damaged.
Well, I think our credibility is absolutely destroyed right now. We've lost just about every ally in the world. We now have the pictures of the torture scenes all over the world.
And worse pictures today being viewed by congressmen.
Yes, and as par for the administration, Mr. Cheney is protecting us by trying to keep us in the dark. He says Americans should not see and should not judge. And it's part of this mind-boggling administration that they who have gotten every single fact wrong, everything that they've said, say that we shouldn't have information to understand what is really happening.
Well, no, hang on a second.
Correct.
I'm not privy to the truth like Mr. Sachs is.
I didn't say I'm privy to the truth.
Some truths have been revealed with time.
That Mr. Cheney
keeps
the information away from us on every step since he's joined the government.
Jeffrey Sachs, let me ask you about Danielle Pletka's point, though. She says, and this is a fact, that Osama bin Laden points to Mogadishu and Somalia and says, look, we killed 18 American soldiers there, and they left. We did it there. We can do it anywhere. Is that not an issue to you? And if it's not, that suggests quite a different view of the world than I think has been sort of the recently traditional U.S. view of the world. What is it?
Well, my view of the world is that when you're in an absolutely disastrous and unsolvable situation, you cut your losses and you get out. And you husband your strength for the fights that we need to fight, like a fight against al-Qaeda, to be sure. But this idea that because we're in and whether you believed it or not, now we have to see it through, that is the logic of utter disaster. It is so false in its premises and its thinking, and it completely misunderstands how much drain we're experiencing right now in our global power because of a lack of authority. Now, Daniel Pletka is the one that came back this fall, last fall from Iraq, and it told us the people are happy.
One moment. Hang on. We'll finish a sentence, and we'll invite you right in.
And that things are going well, and, of course, there are complainers from the outside, but she assured us, along with her colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute, that everything is basically on course. And that was just the time that you and I talked as well. Things are not basically on course. We're turning to Saddam's generals right now as our most desperate
Daniel Pletka,
approach to
Daniel Pletka,
lack of control.
Yeah, please listen in confidence. I'll come to you, and we're with you now.
Okay, thank you. I'm a former congressional staffer. Listening to a filibuster is painful enough from elected officials.
Give us your best shot.
The bottom line is that if you look historically at our wartime experiences, there are times when things go very badly. There were times during World War II when things went badly. There were certainly times in other engagements when things went badly. There were times in Afghanistan in a relatively short war where things were going extraordinarily badly, and everybody said, "Ah, this is a quagmire. Let's get out."
So you think it's just a bad moment in Iraq?
If you are in, and it is a fight worth fighting, then it is a fight worth winning. And it is not worth taking, you know, the problems of several weeks or even several months and giving up what I think is a very honorable and valiant fight.
But we know that it can go badly wrong. I was in Washington just a couple of weeks ago. I stood at the new World War II monument. It can't go right. I stood at the old, at the Vietnam War monument, 50,000 names, and we didn't win. And that's a lot of life down the tubes.
Yes, it is, but World War II took 6 years for the Europeans and 4 years for us. And
Vietnam was a decade, and it didn't work out.
There were plenty of people during the course of the war who said we shouldn't be there.
But wanting to win doesn't mean...
Defeating Saddam Hussein and making an attempt to bring liberty and freedom to the Iraqi people is about as honorable a message as the United States can bring to the rest of the world. Saying we can't take it and we need to be at home so we don't have to face up to bad guys.
Then why is the rest of the world so angry right now, furious?
The rest of the world is going to be angry, and the rest of the world can also be happy. But at the end of the day, it is the American people who need to judge this, not the rest of the world.
Well, there's a lot of American people not too happy tonight.
Well, they will have an opportunity to vote in November. This is a democracy. It's not mob rule.
Mob rule. Yes, it's not mob rule. And with that, we're happy to have a good debate on it. Daniel Pletka, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Great
My
to have
pleasure.
You.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Well, Jeffrey Sachs, there you see the kind of response. Do not cut and run. We can't do it, and we'd leave behind a worse mess in Iraq.
The problem is that the premise that this is a war worth fighting is wrong. This is not a war worth fighting. We went in there on completely phony premises. This is a war that was a war of obsessed people that all through the 1990s wanted us to go to war. September 11 gave them the opportunity to do something that could never have been accepted. The American people were scared out of their wits when the President of the United States said that there was an imminent risk from Saddam Hussein of weapons of mass destruction, and the administration fostered the belief of the close link between Saddam and September 11 and between Saddam and al-Qaeda. It was completely phony.
Jeffrey Sachs, stand by. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. We want to get to the bottom of this. We're talking with Jeffrey Sachs, global economist, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He says the price of this war is not worth paying. What do you think is getting out pie in the sky? Is it irresponsible, or might it be the right thing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the price of a war and an argument for ending it now. Our guest is Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University for 10, 15 more years. Jeffrey Sachs has advised governments around the world at the very top level on every manner of national interest. Now he's advising the U.S. government to leave Iraq ASAP. What do you think? Is it time to cut our losses and get out of Iraq? What would be the price of a U.S. withdrawal? Would it be steeper than staying? And who's keeping it real here, George Bush or Jeffrey Sachs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Duncan's calling from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Duncan. You're on the air. Hello, Duncan. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a couple of points. First of all, I agree with a lot of what Mr. Sachs is saying in terms of reasons for why we shouldn't have gone into Iraq. I actually disagree with his conclusion.
Why?
Well, I think ultimately going in was a mistake, and we have created a mess that we need to fix. And unfortunately, in my view, it's going to be costly in terms of money and in terms of lives. But for us to leave at this point, I think would be disgraceful personally, and I think also in terms of our credibility in the world stage, where we would be viewed as a nation that goes in, creates problems, and leaves when the going gets tough. And you know, I think a lot of these issues were on the table before we went in there, and the viewers or the voters in this country should look at this when we get to November and ask the questions of what we expect from our leaders when these situations come, when they arise in the future. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to be a costly and painful lesson. And I'd throw the same comment out to John Kerry in terms of, you know, why didn't, you know, members of Congress explore these consequences and these issues before we got in there.
Duncan, we've got it. Let me pick it up with Jeffrey Sachs, and thank you for your call. Jeffrey Sachs, disgraceful to leave at this point. We made this mess. It's our job to fix it up.
Let me just propose a thought experiment for a moment. Suppose that in order to stay, the president calls for a draft, and he says that we're going to pay for this war the proper way rather than running a $500 billion deficit, hiding the costs. He's going to raise taxes by $100 billion so that we properly pay. What do you think would happen to political support? I think this war would be over in a snap of a finger. What he's done is hide all the real costs from most of the public, both in terms of who's actually fighting and dying in this war, and also who's paying for it. Well, what we're doing is borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars from the rest of the world. We're creating a massive fiscal crisis. We're creating a balance of payments mess. Oh, it's all being pushed out to the future because he dare not ask the American people actually to pay for this thing.
So you look at Duncan's sense of honor, saying it would be disgraceful to go, and you say that's simply ill-informed. Dear listener, if you knew the real price of this, you wouldn't be so high and mighty about your sense of honor?
Well, we're going to pay for this no matter what. Of course, they want to keep the coffins out of the pictures. Mm. They want to keep everything away from us. They want to keep the financial costs away from us. But we're going to pay for it. We're paying for it dearly. And the idea that we're somehow defending our credibility in all of this, it's so sad. I travel, see leaders and the public, business people all over the world on a regular basis. Nothing has destroyed American credibility like this weird fantasy-based war. And that's not just a feeling in the Middle East where we have true and very high stakes. That's a feeling all over the world in places that once upon a time respected this country. So in terms of credibility, our inability to face up to our mistakes is enormous. Now, I'll say one more thing.
Yeah.
We should try in an honorable way to help. And the way one can do that is financially, for example, through the United Nations. This would be much cheaper than what we're doing right now. Without our soldiers in place and all of the suffering that is creating, if we gave billions of dollars, as we've said we would, for reconstruction, we're not cutting and running. We'd be facing our responsibility. But without creating precisely the disastrous backlash and violence that our presence inherently creates.
So stick around without the bayonets. I want to get one more call here from Dale in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Dale, I think you may want to speak to exactly that point.
Yeah, my thought is that the Congress has passed $87 billion, and the administration is asking for another $25. That's $112 billion.
Not to mention the 70-some that came before.
If we offer $112 billion to the U.N., and say, listen, what we want you to do is to go in and rebuild. We are good at two things. We're good at rebuilding and we're good at financing. We're not good at this war and we're not good at installing a democracy anywhere. We're good at financing and we're good at rebuilding. So let's take the $112 billion and tell the UN, listen, what we want to do is rebuild. Now, what we're going to lose is the business of installing a democracy.
Yeah.
The administration is going to lose its will of channeling that money to political friends, and we're also going to lose touch with 18% of the world's oil. But we will get out and save face, and the Iraqis are not complaining about us rebuilding. They're just complaining about us being there.
And somehow I imagine that oil would keep flowing to the American dollar. Dale, thanks for your call. Jeffrey Sachs, we've just got a couple of minutes left here. I wish you'd speak to the broader context here. Of the economic, the geopolitical reasons that the U.S. is in there in the first place. You've got a broader critique here. What is it?
we have a fantasy world in the Bush administration right now. Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Rumsfeld, they thought starting in the early 1990s that our vast military strength, which is undoubted, could be turned into vast economic riches by controlling Middle East oil, as Dale just said, and vast political hegemony, that somehow we could translate military might into political control. And they took an explicitly neo-imperial vision of the world. Mm-hmm. It's a completely false misunderstanding of where we are in the world right now, which is that people don't want to be occupied and governed by others, and especially in the Middle East, with the history of decades and decades of manipulation and imperial occupation in Iraq and in the neighboring countries. That's why we are such a fundamental allergy, or as I kept saying as we were talking, radioactive to the people of the region. And we should have understood that. We need to learn that unilateralism is not only incredibly expensive, it's bound to fail. And rather than basing our foreign policy on unilateralism and a military approach, we need to base it on multilateralism, sharing burdens, and not on a military approach, but on facing real challenges of hunger or disease or the poverty and joblessness that afflicts so much of the Middle East, making business connections, not making war.
Jeff Sachs, we've just got half a minute left. Yeah. If George Bush isn't proposing a pullout, and he sure isn't, and John Kerry is not proposing a pullout, how does this happen? Is this a dream?
Well, John Kerry is saying exactly right that this unilateralism got us into this fundamental mess. And I know this White House, they don't trust anybody. It's almost a paranoia, but it's also this fantasy of what we can do on our own. And John Kerry is a clear thinker, and he understands fundamentally, and he's been saying, go to the United Nations, make this a multilateral process. Don't attack and slander and belittle our supposed allies. Work with them. Honor them, get them to contribute to this. So this administration's done everything to slap those who could help us in the face or worse.
So I hear you saying you think, underneath the covers, John Kerry is more likely to go the multilateral path, maybe even the pullout path.
No question. He tells us that every day.
Jeff Sachs, always great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much.
Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a former military police commander shares his outrage at the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse. This is On Point. Members of Congress saw new, more explicit photos today of the torture and humiliation of Iraqi prisoners at the hands of U.S. soldiers inside Abu Ghraib prison. Republican Representative Wayne Gilchrist of Maryland summed up his reaction to the pictures in four words: disgust, anger, rage, sadness. Virginia resident James Villa is also disgusted with the images he has seen from Abu Ghraib. During the first Gulf War, he commanded the 372nd Military Police Company, the unit that is now in the middle of the prisoner abuse scandal. In this radio diary, James Villa laments the actions of his former company and says there is a lot of blame to go around.
From 1989 to 1992, I commanded the 372nd MP Company, the Army Reserve Unit from Cumberland, Maryland, that is at the center of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. In the years since then, I've had an enduring affection for the unit and those who serve in it. Today, what I feel is a sort of sickness and shame at having been affiliated with the 372nd. There are many things about the incidents at Abu Ghraib that we do not know. Given the involvement of military intelligence issues, there are many critical things that we may never know, but there are a few conclusions we can certainly draw. These actions were the results of huge command failures. The senior person charged thus far is Ivan Frederick, a staff sergeant. In an MP company, a person of his rank is normally placed in charge of a squad of 11 soldiers. I refuse to believe that no leader above Frederick was aware of or complicit in the abuses that were apparently widespread throughout the prison. While certain officers were relieved of their commands and other leaders were given letters of reprimand, the failure of unit leaders from company to brigade is stunning. The 372nd has approximately 150 soldiers and is divided into five platoons. The 372nd's commander and the relevant platoon leader either knew or should have known of the actions of their subordinates, as should have their non-commissioned officers. All these leaders failed in the most basic responsibilities of supervising their soldiers in the performance of their duties. Brigadier General Janis Karpinski, commander of the 800th MP Brigade, which ran the prison, has spent most of the past week on television telling the same story, that she never knew about this, that her MPs were working for military intelligence people, that she was not to blame. Had she spent as much time leading her troops as apparently she has preparing for appearances on MSNBC, the Army might have stemmed these incidents early on. I was taught in ROTC that a leader is responsible for what his or her unit does or fails to do. I was also taught that a leader takes responsibility for his or her soldiers. Either by commission or omission, Karpinski and her entire chain of command have failed those soldiers in her brigade and, ultimately, this country. The soldiers in question are nonetheless culpable for their own actions. Like all MPs, the soldiers in the 372nd have received basic instruction on handling enemy prisoners of war. The most essential instruction regarding prisoners is the five S's: search, segregate, silence, safeguard, and speed to the rear. These simple directions clearly state that an MP must ensure that a prisoner is disarmed and, once rendered harmless, protected as a non-combatant and moved back for processing. The responsibility to safeguard prisoners is a basic function of an MP unit on the battlefield. Various people, including the families of some of the soldiers in question, have said the soldiers were not given appropriate training to run a detention facility and had inadequate support to do their jobs. While these statements may be true, in what Army field manual can one locate the section about stacking naked prisoners like cordwood or affixing collars to their necks? Is special training needed to show a soldier that this sort of thing is contemptible and contrary to any standards of decency? Further, it is no defense for MPs to claim that they were only following orders, that they were instructed to soften up prisoners to enhance subsequent interrogations. While battlefield intelligence gleaned from interrogations may prove invaluable and can save American lives, no officer, no sergeant has the authority to direct a soldier to commit an atrocity or to violate the Geneva Conventions. While soldiers in a combat environment may face split-second decisions involving difficult moral choices, this was not the case here. We are confronted with picture after picture, story upon story, detailing systematic abuse and degradation by American MPs. We have a right to expect more from our military. To minimize the egregious conduct of some members of the 372nd and their superiors dishonors those men and women who honorably serve their country. We must not, as some commentators have said, deem this to be soldiers blowing off steam and equate it to fraternity initiations. To me, that sort of response dishonors those who strive each day to serve their fellow soldiers and complete their missions, and who risk their lives to do so. Further, minimizing the conduct of these MPs by comparing it to the reckless and violent acts of Iraqi insurgents is wholly beside the point. We must compare our actions to those of the men and women who have honorably served this country. If our claim is merely that we are better than the terrorists, we leave a tenuous legacy for a budding democracy in Iraq. The 372nd has a distinguished record, having been in both the Gulf War and in Bosnia. The soldiers with whom I serve were some of the most dedicated and talented military people I know. The acts committed at Abu Ghraib have disgraced all of us. I hope that the corrective action by the Army and appropriate punishment for those guilty will help restore the pride that the 372nd and the MP Corps have earned.
Former Captain James Villa commanded the 372nd MP Company during the First Gulf War. He works now as an attorney with the federal government in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.